With your permission, we'd like to talk shop for just a moment.
Because we've got a good racket going, you're not going to be able to touch our own.
Oh, okay, so you've got a racket going.
Cookies are not the only food. I tell that to my children all the time.
It's time for the publisher fight. It's time for the publisher fight.
Here's a man that really appreciates that new England pound.
Hi, how's it going, and welcome to the Video Week podcast. My name is Vincent Flood. I'm the editor-in-chief at Video Week, and in this episode I'm speaking to Jay Prasad. Jay is CEO at Relometrics. Relometrics are tackling a part of the marketing and advertising industry that I think myself and I think many others are fascinated by from afar but don't actually know all that much about. They look at sports sponsorships particularly, or sports marketing in a broader terms. They're trying to measure things like, you know, the logo displayed in the stadium, but also then tying together the bigger picture, the impacts that these partnerships have as these logos and the branding is displayed across various different screens, from TV right through to social posts by fans, then everything that happens for fans inside the stadium as well. So it's a very complex challenge and particularly interesting. And we get into how the deals work, what success looks like for these brands, and how brands view the role of a sports sponsorship in their overall marketing mix. And before we get into that, just a few things from Video Week. We've got an exceptionally busy few weeks in September and early October. Firstly, we have Video Week Cologne coming up the day before to Mexico on 17th of September. That's a half-day conference, and the idea is to bring the buyers and sellers in video and CTV advertising together for a half day before the event. We don't view ourselves as competitors to the large, huge expos like the Mexico. In fact, we're a very proud partner. But the idea is, I think, maybe to act as a little bit of a filter that we sort of bring together the Video Week community or audience together the day before. In fact, on day one at the Mexico, if you're going to be there, I'll be on the center stage around lunchtime. I think it's just before lunch. And I'll be doing an interview with Bert Habets, Group CEO at ProSiebenSat.1. That's something that I'm very much looking forward to. ProSieben are by far one of the most interesting and important companies in Europe, and I'm looking forward to digging into things with Bert. Then we also have the European Video Awards ceremony in London. That's on September 26th. People sometimes ask if you have to be nominated in order to attend, and we do reserve an allocation for the nominees, of course, but you are welcome to join us. It's always a very interesting room of interesting brands, agencies, broadcasters, publishers, tech companies, and so you can book that your tickets for that one. Then a few days later, my long-suffering team will be all be going off to San Sebastian in Spain for TV Rise, my personal favorite of all our events. TV Rise is our CTV leadership forum, and that'll be going from 1st to 3rd of October. You can find links to all these events at videoweek.com, and yeah, just get in touch if you'd like to be an event partner. Right, now I will cross over to my conversation with Jay, which I hope you enjoy. So Jay, finally we got there. Great to have you on the podcast.
Nice to be back. I think it's been a few years.
It has indeed. I've been following your career for quite some years now, since you were an early veteran in the programmatic video space. But before we're going to have plenty of time to dig into Relometrics. But I'm curious, expand a bit on your journey to getting there. You know, starting from that initial beachhead into the industry, right up to becoming CEO of Relometrics.
Yeah, look, my journey started a long time ago now. I just had another birthday. It's quite shocking sometimes when you think about how long you've been doing stuff. But, you know, I started my career in management consulting at Ernst & Young, and then the Arthur Andersen before it sort of got dismantled. But those were great learning experiences. It was kind of like a business boot camp. but it also happened to be around the time of the first dot-com wave. And I really got that bug early on in my career, sort of like at age 23, 24, and decided that consulting wasn't for me. And I started building companies back then in that era. And that's really what got me into understanding software and all the various use cases software could do. And with the internet, software completely changed. And you know, there's a lot of parallels to what we're seeing happening now with AI. But you know, at that point, you went from these desktop computing systems or ERPs, as they were known back then, you know, like your SAPs and your Oracles and things like that, into all these new types of software applications. And I really sort of kept going with that and have been involved in super early startups, but also spent almost 4 years at Yahoo. And so throughout this journey, it's been this intersection of software, marketing, and ultimately into measurements. And that's what really ended up kind of capturing my most attention. And so that being in that early set of technologies, and then also really having a front row seat to all of the various content and digitization of content for the web and then the mobile web and now streaming. It's been amazing, right? Because I was fortunate enough to sort of start my career at the beginning of the most important wave, and then I've been able to be a part of all the subsequent ones. And over time, yeah, like I said, I started to focus more on measurement. It just really seemed like an interesting place to be in a market where you have to be trusted by all parts of an ecosystem, right? You have to be trusted by the buyers, the sellers, the technology now that connects the buyers and the sellers, and you have to be neutral and you have to have transparency in your methodology. You don't have you know, a dog in the fight of who gets the better deal. You're just trying to make liquidity happen in a marketplace. And doing that, starting with the early Yahoo days when we were trying to figure out how much Yahoo video reach had compared to TV, right? Like these are problems that we were working on in like 2008 and 2009, right? Because Yahoo was the leading video platform at the time. You know, to my time at VideoAmp, where we knew that, hey, if you're going to have this more cross-screen viewing experience and you're going to have this fragmentation of audiences, there's no way that a type, you know, panel-based system that's only measuring demos is going to be the solution for the future. And then it wasn't just, oh, well, what measurement metrics do represent the future? It now has to be a part of a full stack, right? It has to have a data strategy that's cloud ready. It has to have software tools. It now has to have AI on top of those software tools. So measurement has become a much broader thing, yet it still has such an important part of any marketplace.
It's tough business. I think you haven't chosen the easy path either. I think measurements requires patience and quite a lot of persistence. I think for any
You're
company
right.
going in,
Yeah.
it's
There's no way in measurement to go from 0 to 100 and have like a huge pop. You basically have to build it and grind it out. So yeah, you're right. You have to kind of love the journey. And you don't really get the instant gratification. It does take a lot of time and trust.
So let's dig into Relo and what Relo is. Also, yeah, it might be good if you explain firstly to the relationship with GumGum, and yeah, just give us a high level overview of what Relo is, and we'll dig in a bit deeper as
Yeah.
we go on.
Right. So, yeah, RelaMetrics is an independent subsidiary of GumGum, and that happened in late 2021. But the company itself was started inside of GumGum back in 2018. And we know that GumGum is a pioneer in contextual advertising. I believe that they just turned 16 years old. So, really, truly pioneering and almost helped create and usher in what contextual advertising is. And if you think about what contextual advertising is, it's understanding the semantics around where an ad could be placed. So whether it's understanding a web page, whether it's now understanding a video, if you're not going to use personal information or behavioral targeting or audience-based targeting, it's going to have to be based on context. And for the context to be accurate, you have to really dig into the technology that's going to allow that to happen. So in around 2018, they started working on sort of R&D with some of the contextual technologies that were being used on the web and seeing if it can be applied to sports in the way of doing logo detection. So, when you think about sports measurement, and we'll get into a little bit more about the history there, but that's why the idea of measuring sports and understanding the context in terms of what logos and brands are being integrated into all these games, that's really what spawned at that time then was called GumGum Sports. And it was early in the space. There were a couple of other companies that were also starting to come around that time. But sports measurement in terms of who are the sponsors, what are the logos, where is it on the field? And nowadays, you also have it in the pre-game shows and po post-game shows. In the industry, they call that shoulder programming. You've got virtual integrations of cool creative now during broadcast. There's just a lot of things happening. And in the early days, what you had were stopwatches and interns. And when YouTube was available, they were using YouTube clips, and they were basically spreadsheets to calculate, well, what happened for these sponsors during this particular game? And you can guarantee that they were not doing that for every game. So it's like, okay, we're going to do it for a few games with interns and stopwatches and Microsoft Excel, and then we'll sort of put a formula on it, and then that'll be the number, right? I mean, that's how archaic this stuff was. A lot of agencies had to do this because there wasn't the technology to scale to do this. And obviously, that early contextual analysis eventually became all a part of the computer vision wave. And we can dive more into that. But computer vision really took off as one of the first AI technologies in roughly 2014, meaning it was still in R&D on universities with lots of white papers. And that the whole idea was, can the computer see? Can the computer see this video or see this image and understand what's in it? Which by nature now it seems like, of course it can, but it wasn't able to. So that was really one of the first major fields of AI, which is around this idea of how to make a computer see, which was the whole science of computer vision. And obviously now it's scaled and it's at an unparalleled rate. And that's one of the key components of for definitely for any data labeling exercise. Sports is obviously a industry where you have this, but you have another spin-off from GumGum called Pearl. And Pearl is in the dental space. I was just telling you, Vincent, earlier about my dentist experience yesterday afternoon. But Pearl was designed with computer vision because if you're looking at X-rays that a dentist might look at, the computer can pick up small little anomalies that are not eye detectable. And so therefore there's a way to automate, create efficiencies, and maybe more quality, right? And they're doing amazing. They just raised a massive round a couple of weeks ago. So computer vision is now really hitting its stride. And what we're doing is really trying to perfect it for sports and live entertainment.
So, in doing that, in terms of the methodology, I mean, how far do you go with this? I mean, is it primarily right? You've got your TV broadcast, you've got the social stuff, which I'd imagine is sprawled across the internet. Do you also look at the experience in a venue, for example? Is that something that you look at as well?
Yeah, we just launched an in-venue measurement tool 2 weeks ago. And getting to where we are now in terms of both the adoption of the technology and the scale of the amount of games and matches that we're analyzing from just a broadcast and streaming is roughly like 5,000 a year. That's a lot of minutes, right? 5,000, I mean, European football matches are 3+ hours, baseball games are about 3 hours. So it is just a long time to have to analyze frame by frame. And that means that you are very much focused on camera visible assets, right? So the things that end up on camera end up on the big screen, and then those clips from the big screen end up on the small screen, right? It ends up getting distributed into social media, gets distributed to Sky Sports and ESPN.com and Bleacher Report and all of these various sports sites around the world. And so you're really just continuously valuing and analyzing more of the same asset that was camera visible. It's just now appearing in new environments. But the question is, well, for a long season, right? Like just look at, for example, the NBA regular season, which just wrapped up in June. And this year, the NBA had 22 million fans watch its regular season games, which is amazing, right? It's like an 82-game season. So there's plenty of games. But that's an awful lot of people, 22 million, who are, almost solely engaged in what's around them. And when, for example, there's a TV timeout, there's all of this entertainment that is happening on the court. And mostly those things are in conjunction with a partner, right? So it could be a local sponsor, it could be a national sponsor, it doesn't matter. But all of that that's not now on camera was not being measured in the same way that the camera visible assets are. So to create consistency and have like a total sports and entertainment methodology, we felt that we had to add in venue. And that was a whole journey because you can't use all the same techniques, right? We have to actually understand sight lines in a stadium, and every arena and every stadium is different. So you have to understand sight lines and then where things are happening. If it's happening, in the center of the field or the center of the court, then everyone can see it. But if there is, let's say, an activation happening only in the left end zone, then that's not going to be super visible to everybody else. Then there's also things that run on the scoreboard or run on the LEDs during a game that are not camera visible. So then we actually need runtime data. Like think of almost like in the from an ad tech perspective, it's like the ad server logs, right? These runtimes are programmed into all these now digital places where you have these brand activations, and then we have to use those as well. So that, and then you're no longer using from a media equivalency standpoint, like in TV, you're using spot cost rates. In social and digital, you're using eCPMs, and you can get average costs for ads pretty easily. But what about something in a stadium, right? So for now, we're using digital out of home as a proxy for what something is worth. But ultimately, we want to get it to a fan level measurement. So that's where this methodology is going. But to do this in venue means that now you can do things like live concerts. And we actually have some brands who've engaged us to do that starting next year. Because you think about like all these big concerts, music festivals, things of the like, they've definitely become much more brand partnership centric. And these are not usually on TV. And if they are on TV, it's like maybe on YouTube. So it's not like the same thing. It's like a Premier League match, right? It's not like appointment viewing television to watch a concert. And these are happening all the time, almost every weekend in the summer. And so now there's going to be a way to actually measure those things properly, which is really exciting because it really helps us venture, into the world of live entertainment a little bit more deeply as well.
I'm curious about how, so much of what you're talking about is, the sort of next generation of sports sponsorship looks like it's going to be far more analytical, far more quantitative. But, it has been something of a fluffy world in the past. I mean, you sort of mentioned earlier about the Excel spreadsheets and, but, I'm curious about how brands view and value sports partnerships. Is this something that's, they is carefully integrated into a wider full funnel campaign strategy? Are these seen as maybe separate activations, which, are, money's just allocated to, and it's sort of seen as essential for the brand to be affiliated with, event XYZ? I mean, how is it you yeah, how is it viewed by brands?
I think historically, especially local brands, they want the allure of being associated with their hometown heroes, right? These teams and athletes are very high profile in any community. And oftentimes, right, there's gut feel involved of a CEO of a hospital, let's say. I mean, healthcare is a huge sponsor in sports, right? I mean, so many baseball stadiums have the local healthcare provider, like that's going to be your scoreboard sponsor, things of that nature. So there was a lot of that. And as a result, there wasn't a lot of demand for rigor in evaluating like what these things are worth. But that has completely changed. And it's because for a couple of reasons. The big massive sponsors are now in sports in a big way, right? So I'll use like State Farm Insurance, for example, right? It's someone that we work with our partners at Omnicom. And State Farm is a massive US insurance company, and they are integrated into hundreds of places at any one given time. So if you're going to have that many investments in sports, you need a more organized way to just manage that portfolio and also to evaluate that investment. Because we know that all major brands evaluate their ad strategies on a day-to-day basis, right? Programmatic, part of the beauty is that you can change anything at any time and try to get better results. That rigor has come somewhat now to television and streaming, maybe not quite as minute, but still that kind of rigor now applies to almost all forms of paid media. And therefore, the measurement is more granular. So the demand for sports to have that granularity and a model in terms of a methodology and transparency approach that gives confidence in those numbers is required. You mentioned something else around being integrated into broader campaign strategies, and then I think we were going to talk a little bit about how does it feed full funnel measurement. But for those brands who are spending in sports, so whether it's you're a sponsor in sports, but you're also having like the key category exclusivity in the ad breaks, right? So you're going to be the only auto company in these ad breaks, for the year. You usually want to coordinate those things. And then you also want to have a coordinated digital extension of that campaign, right? So because you probably have custom creative around your sports strategy. And obviously with the Olympics, this was on full display where there's almost every ad break has got this Olympic themed creatives. And so your digital advertising during the Olympics is probably going to want to be coordinated. And if those brands are also brands that are integrated into the actual teams themselves, or for example, in the opening ceremony, there's even more reason to tie all of the ads and sponsorships together creatively, but also to buy and activate in a way where they are complementary of one another. And then that, of course, means that you're measuring it in a more harmonic way. And that's something that we are actively working on, is to take sports measurement and integrate it to the broader measurement stacks that have proliferated through all other forms of media.
Just staying on the Olympics. I mean, is there any brands that activated particularly well, and why do you think that they activated particularly well? I mean, sometimes, with large sporting events, sometimes, you've got, when I think of World Cup sponsors, for example, I'll often think of the companies who had their logo around the edge of the stadium, and and they might creep into the advertising as well. But yeah, I wouldn't necessarily directly associate them with the event sponsorship. But the Olympics is a good recent example to look at. Which brands stand out to you?
Yeah, this Olympics, there was, being in Paris, and I think fashion took front and center. LVMH was really the official sponsor of the Paris Games, and obviously the world's biggest and most admired luxury brand. So this was a much more fashion-forward Olympics. So also, I think if you noticed, there was a lot more sponsor integrations into different events, and I wasn't at the Olympics, unfortunately, this time around, but the What I had some of my team in London go, and what they were telling me is that there was just activations happening all over the place. And it's been kind of widely discussed that this is definitely a bigger set of marketing integrations than in past Olympics. I think you mentioned the World Cup. The World Cup has already been big and is a bit more front forward, right? Like you see during the match play in the World Cup, there's sponsors all over that stadium. Stadium sponsorships are not as prevalent in the Olympics. I did not see consistency that every event had brands integrated into each of these environments, right? I mean, some of the stuff was in the Seine River, some of these things are in the Grand Palais for fencing. So there was not that necessarily consistency. But because this fashion forward Olympics also then had these team outfits, right? So LVMH outfitted the French team, and Ralph Lauren outfitted the American team. These were the two that stood out. We just put out some data recently here that recaps the Olympics, and we discovered that those brands had obviously integrations with the teams that then ended up on social media, right? For all of those athletes and the team pages, et cetera. But those brands also have their own pages. What we saw was a massive outperformance and engagement for a brand like LVMH or Ralph Lauren with their associated Olympic team athletes and pages versus their own owned and operated pages. So that was a clear halo that, hey, people love those brands to begin with, but the amount of scale of engagement and views and things of that nature happening were really completely outpaced by what was happening with the teams and the athletes.
Can you think of an example of a bad sponsorship? You know, is there sports sponsorships that go wrong?
Yeah, look, there's tactical things like your logo is blurry on camera, or it's consistently cut off. And we actually advise on these things, right? So we notice these things in our system. You know, when we were talking a little about methodology, we don't just say, hey, these logos were on screen for X amount of seconds. We actually run a six-part methodology for quality. So how many logos are on that screen? What's the share of voice between logos? Which ones are blurry? Which ones are clear? Are certain ones animated now because there's just more technology into how these sponsorships work? Those things all end up into what we call an MVP score, which is basically taking the media value and discounting it based on quality. So while doing that, we do discover just creative that's not working well, or the messaging doesn't fit the sports environment, right? It's like they're adapting a broader campaign strategy into their sports sponsorship and it just doesn't match, and therefore doesn't resonate in social media. So what works on broadcast and what works in social media are also different. And your post strategy for social needs to be an extension of what you see on camera, but it needs to have the right kind of character alignment, contextual alignment, or certain athletes do better than others. So these are all variables that can determine if it's successful or not. Some of it is super easy and tactical, and then some of it you just have to really understand that this is now communication happening. When it goes from the broadcast to social media and digital, it's now just as much a communication strategy as it is a sponsorship strategy.
Is the real-time marketing still a big buzz thing in the sort of sports marketing world? Where, you know, I think there was that example where from the Oreo did it was an NBA game, wasn't it? Where the lights went out, was it? And
Yeah.
it very quickly how they had a an ad service. Is that still a thing where you've got teams watching the games and ready to make these tactical responses?
Yeah. I mean, these are super buttoned up professional organizations with production staffs and event staffs that, operate the arenas. And so they have contingency plans for almost any and all things, right? Especially outdoor stadiums when weather comes. But that's an example of like where you could see things going, right? Because the broadcaster can also do things in terms of injecting something into the broadcast that helps the experience if, in case of a lights out type emergency. But you also think about, all the surfaces on an arena. Pretty much everything is an LED screen, right? So everything could be more dynamic, right? Like just sort of brainstorming and riffing, like what if during any game that was really tight and it was coming down to the last couple of minutes, that you made a call out to see if anyone wants to, in real time, I'm not saying like an open marketplace, but hey, these are brands that we've vetted their creative and we're going to create a contextual moment right now during these parts of a game and who wants it, right? And you could basically have a bit more of a dynamic market to see who would pay for what. And what would that experience be? And did that work better? So there's a lot of places where you see these surfaces, and that opens up new opportunity. It does. Like we're going from banners that were tied, with zip ties to all, real advanced LED surfaces that get bigger and bigger, right? Like here in Southern California, if you've ever been to SoFi Stadium and you look and see that video screen, which is the scoreboard, I mean, it's mind-boggling. And then what an amazing surface that is, right? For entertainment, partnerships with brands, all of it.
So today, I assume it's a fixed fee for a sports sponsorship typically. But like you say, yeah, it's very similar conversations to we have that we have in TV, in advertising where, programmatic has helped people get the best out of those, peaks. And if we have a sudden peak in demand that maybe we hadn't accounted for, that we're able to monetize that incremental demand. If, like you say, the game gets particularly exciting or such and such a team have qualified for the final, and but are these deals typically prearranged ahead of time, locked in at a certain price level, or is there a a sort of some sort of performance mechanism built into the deals?
Yeah, they are pretty locked in, but there is a usually some kind of value that is also placed on that, right? So like if you're paying $1 million for a sponsorship, how are you going to measure value? And that's absolutely where we come in. But yes, the opportunity to also have flex arrangements where you can add things or rotate things can be built into agreements. But this idea of taking advantage of peak drama or moments, I think is a newer concept, but it's something that you're not going to open it up to just anybody, right? I mean, it's still going to be a super premium set of partners that get that opportunity. But that could be an interesting way to have flex time, is to create moments and then have a sort of, like, in programmatic terms, right, a private marketplace full of vetted creative from partners, and see how those things can get integrated into the action.
Yeah, I can see this benefiting, particular stars as well. You think that the Turkish shooting star, who was very much a huge hit this year, and I think they had the opportunities for people like him, if even for the athletes themselves, if they were able to activate things in real time, I think could be very interesting. Are you guys looking also? I mean, if you were to take out the European Championships and the Olympics, I think the major event of the year was probably Taylor Swift's tour. And I'm curious, are you guys looking outside of sports as well?
Yeah, I would say that live entertainment overall, so whether they be music concerts or award shows, those are definitely places where we're seeing activity and asks from both brands as well as partners on the media side. So, we work with teams, leagues, brands, agencies, and then also the media rights holder, right? So, your Disney's and Sky's of the world, who own a lot of the media rights, and we're working with a lot of those companies as well. And they all have different parts of the ecosystem that they monetize in their specific way. So all these things are kind of melding. And there's more partnership, right? So with these increasing amount of media rights, the NBA's deal, like what, $72 billion just got signed here, and it's got, NBC and Amazon and ESPN as its main partners. They're all going to have different schedules and different assets and different ways in which they're going to present, these NBA games. And there's going to be a brand in all of these environments in some way, right? It's just the way it works now. And that's going to be a fun challenge to figure out how to make it all work harmonically across all of these different parts of the ecosystem.
One thing I love about speaking to people like you, who you've been, you're very much, you've been deep in the weeds on our, I suppose, Video Week's conventional side of the fence, the video and TV trading side of things. And I'm curious, if you had, is there an industry problem that you can look at now as, with a fresh pair of eyes? What industry problem do you think, most needs to be fixed?
So I think that the building these kind of entertainment and sports integrations into the funnel where you can actually measure the performance, meaning that, hey, this actually logically fits into an MMM model, right? Which is just sort of a way of looking at my multi-mix marketing model and understanding what's driving value. And then how are you going to measure value from these things? Is it going to be dealer visits? And new car test drives? Is it going to be insurance policy starts? There's going to be some form of engagement that many brands want to drive to. It has historically just been like that brand halo, like, hey, now my brand is like front and center. But how are you going to measure that performance alongside what you would be doing for your programmatic ads, right? So connecting those dots is definitely, I think, an industry problem to solve. I think secondly is that measurement companies and so many companies, like hundreds and thousands of SaaS companies, are in essence dashboards, right? It's collecting and synthesizing a lot of data, and it's presenting it in a clean manner with a lot of filters, and then you've got lots of charts, and then hopefully you can make those things into a meaningful presentation. Now, that is not going to be enough in the future. We are awash in data. Like all these advancements, like we were talking about earlier in computer vision, means that, we have hundreds and thousands of rows of data. We are measuring 7 to 8 million social posts a year. Like these are just a lot of data. And underneath that, you've got all these different metrics from each of those posts or each of these broadcasts, which are done in 3 second frames. It's just a lot of data. So how do you actually get what's important from that data to your customers? And then how do your customers understand how to please their customers, right? Whether it's the fan or whether it's one of their sponsors. And that problem needs to be solved in software. And then you have this other idea that, well, if AI keeps on this path and everyone's got a co-pilot and an assistant, then you're not really going to have everyone's use case be, I'm going to train you how to create filters and rules. And then these are going to be the analytics and the charts that you see. You're going to just have to be able to like say, hey, RevoBot, please show me the best options I have for an airline and give me a competitive analysis of who's all in the airline space in my sport. And then ultimately create me a proposal to send to this airline, right? You're going to have to be able to do that. And that's going to be a big challenge for everyone because the business models are going to change too. As you get more and more streamlined in what you do, maybe your pricing model doesn't work as well anymore in that kind of world. So there's a lot of things that I think are going to be changing here in the next 18 to 24 months.
Yeah, I do think brand will still matter though. I think people are still, even when if you were if you know your AI co-pilot is presenting with a set of options, I think the brand of the airline would
Oh,
make a
yeah.
difference. I think that yeah, but branding is still going to play a huge role.
Brand will become more important because this is how, when done correctly, you stand out.
It's I'm curious. Do you encounter people, sometimes there's been a bit of a a little bit of pushback against more granular measurement, where keeping things a little bit opaque, fluffy. It seems like the partners are okay with, whatever measurement metrics they've been given. Sometimes it's an accepted currency, and everyone goes home happy and has a vague idea. Do you get in the TV industry, particularly that's been well, there's two schools. There are the schools who completely embrace granularity, and there are others who don't quite so much. I assume, do you encounter the same thing in the sports world?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think it's been historically like one of the main drivers is that having opaque measurement means that you can just keep doing these kinds of sponsorships and don't have to be totally accountable. But I think management has changed on that. But absolutely, I think that was a legacy piece of these sports deals is like, you know what? I'm in the luxury box. I've got autographs. I can, I'm the coolest person in my cul-de-sac, right? Because I'm the one who's got access to the games and the athletes. And that's a powerful thing in a community. So measurement might not make that, as transparent that that's what you should be doing for your particular brand at that particular time. But that's absolutely, giving way to a more rational approach to measure these things. And then I think another like interesting thing is like this ends up looking a lot like consumer, but if you look at sports like F1 and golf, it's very B2B, right? So like being a team sponsor in Formula One and being able to bring, whether it's CEOs or CIOs, from all of your customers, because there's a lot of technology companies that are sponsors of F1 teams, and you can bring them into the paddock, right, at these races, that's huge, right? Like each one of those relationships could be worth multiple millions of dollars, right? So, now you're actually measuring qualified leads with executives, right? That's a totally different paradigm than like an auto brand or an insurance brand, which is like, just, hey, everyone can be my customer, versus these sports where not everyone is your customer. It really matters who you're entertaining and bringing into the hospitality side of sports marketing, which is the other big side. I know I don't talk about it a lot because we don't really do a lot in the hospitality part of this, but we have partners and agencies that we work with all the time that do. But now, even those hospitality-driven sponsorships are looking for some kind of accountability. So it's like, all right, well, what's driving new pipeline development in your Salesforce account, right? And how is that being tied to what you did at Formula One? And that's an area that is happening right now.
There's a lot of very nervous agency execs looking over their shoulders. I'm curious about how you view the programmatic space. I mean, you've been around, since the early days. I'm curious, to what extent do you think it's delivered on the original vision? This is a question that we're going to be asking at
Yeah.
various events and have been asking throughout the year. But it feels, yeah, I'm curious about how you feel it's evolved.
I think it's delivered on the promise of removing friction from buying and selling and creating a bigger market for more brands and advertisers to come into all of these new ad environments, right? And that, I think that promise has been delivered. But even since the beginning days, right, programmatic has had issues with fraud, right? And then when the transition into CTV and streaming came in, that just meant higher CPMs for bad acting. And I think that combined with like the pretty frustrating experience on mobile apps, like you want to read this article, but you can't X out of this thing. And when you scroll, it follows you. You end up just canceling out. For me, I do that. I feel that's where programmatic has gone wrong. Where the marketplace dynamics or incentives have basically created bad consumer experiences. And that's a problem. I think, here in the US, there's been huge growth in fast channels, right? All the smart TVs with hundreds of channels. But there's very repetitive ads. The creative is not very good. And it's not the great experience. And therefore, the rates go down. So then those publishers are having a harder time, monetizing their channel. And they're trying to create good, meaningful content. But how can you do that when the only way you get, monetized is through these ads where the rates keep going down because of those other issues? So you have these cycles that you have to solve. And to me, those are the same cycles that I saw in 2013. They're just now in more environments.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's probably someone listening to this and thinking, maybe we could create a fake sports team or
But, right, they have an all AI generated broadcast, right? And put all these logos in there and they tell us to measure it.
you'll probably have that pitch within a week. If you had, okay, yeah, our final question. We give a unfortunately fictional $10 million to each person to invest. Where would you invest that and why?
If I'm going to stick into okay, one option would be, all right, what do we see happening right now? And why is sports so important, right? Like, it seems like sports has always been important, but I think in this culture right now, it is the dominant thing that actually makes people happy. It unites people, right? You may definitely have a lot of animosity towards your rival, but together you still love football. And in a divided world, so sports just seems to be playing a bigger role. It's the only thing people make appointments to watch on TV, right? I guess people watch news, but like, let's face it, the news is not extremely exciting or positive these days in any way, right? And so sports has just got more importance. And the other thing that's happening is there's new sports and opportunities coming in. There's so many emerging sports now, and because it's having a moment, you're getting more opportunities. So whether it's just new women's sports leagues, and the growth of those leagues, I mean, if you could invest in owning a part of a fast-growing women's football team or WNBA team, that would be a non-technology bet to make, right? Because it's probably going to appreciate a lot in value in the next, in the coming years. There's also just breakthrough new sports that are happening, right? Like, you see hundreds of them in the Olympics. There's some subset of that that is going to end up being like the next thing. Like recently we started working with the American Cornhole Championships, right? That's like a backyard thing that has become a professional sport with prize money that's on ESPN too, right?
Sorry, what was that? The American Cornhole?
American Cornhole Championships. So, like when you're tossing a beanbag onto a board and there's a hole and you got to get it in there.
Oh, yes, sorry. Yes,
Yeah, it's kind of an American thing, but like
yeah.
that's actually
No,
a
I've seen it.
professional sport and we're measuring that and that's cool. So emerging sports could be another place to make investments. And then from a technology standpoint, because you have more teams and more athletes and, absolutely, more gender representation in sports where people are becoming stars, how do you make it more effective for them to monetize their brand? Outside of what the team in the league's doing, right? Because the team in the league control a lot of like, hey, when I'm wearing my uniform during a game, like that, what's on there is what's on there, right? I can't put my own stuff on there, but what you do online and in social is yours. And so I think there needs to be better tools and better measurement for all of those experiences that all of these new athletes, I mean, you can lump them all together. They're creators, they're influencers, they're athletes. They're all of a similar ilk where they have unique talent that is attracting an audience. and they want to have more brand partners. So how do you connect the dots for them, from the real world into the physical world in a way that makes it as liquid as what we're seeing in sports sponsorships?
Jay, that was a very fascinating insight into a world that I've always been really curious about. When you see sports sponsorship, it's something that seems so close to our world and yet always seems quite far away. That tends to happen in the media and marketing world anyway. You can have these massive industries that are parallel and never really seem to join up, or at least in my experience. So that was absolutely fascinating, and I am I'm going to start a European Women's Cornhole League, and
There you go. We'll get the seed capital together.
That was my key takeaway. No, really, that was fascinating, and best of luck with everything that you're building there at Rollout Metrics.
Thanks, Vincent. It's great to speak with you, and I'll see you when I'm over next.